are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, October 3rd, 2017. My name is Michael Brooks, and this is the 5-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Paris-based labor and political journalist Cole Stangler on Emmanuel Macron's war on French labor, the broader neoliberal plan that Macron has for France and France's actual left resistance to it, how it fits into the broader global pattern, ongoing fallout from the largest mass shooting in American history, death toll apparently now up to 59 people, many Republicans, commentariat, they have a lot of ideas, whether it's about God or disrespecting the president, or Alex Jones, of course, has a theory that you will not want to miss.
Usually it's the prayers that help, but I think this time it's the thoughts have been really comforted.
Yeah, I think more so the thoughts. You're right. Usually prayer is the leading indicator. But of course, it would be absolutely offensive to talk about the domestic arms lobby that holds the entire country hostage just so they can wring out more profits. Donald Trump is apparently headed to Puerto Rico. Almost certainly he will face protests. And if he is allowed to, maybe we'll see a whole lot of in-person human suffering that he will also have no empathy and concern for. Even as Oxfam has noted the failure of the Trump administration in dealing with Puerto Rico. Leading Kurdish political figure dies in Kurdistan, in Iraqi Kurdistan, even as the Iraqi federal government is amping up pressure on the Kurdish region in light of a pro-independence vote. And the Spanish state also reacting with violence and extremism to an independence vote in Catalonia. Supreme Court set to hear a landmark case on redistricting, and Bernie Sanders condemns the attack in Las Vegas, says we need to do something about it. Is he going to make a move on guns? Before we get to Cole, we actually, I recorded the interview with Cole at about 11 a.m. So we have that all queued up and ready to go. But let's, I don't have a sound sheet yet. So which one are we? Let's actually start with this. In light of this attack, there's a lot of very important points that, you know, that are to be made. I think that understanding the NRA and the domestic arms market as a business interest that has financial capture over the Republican Party is even, I think is actually more profitable kind of political economy understanding than even the sort of cultural politics of guns, in my view. So I think it's important to look at it that way. I think it's obviously quite notable and important and clear that in the race politics and race history of America, that obviously when white people commit acts of mass atrocity and violence, it is categorized as a one-off or in context. It's never, you know, it's never white on white crime or, you know, something like that. And I think that, you know, if you can imagine if a black man was at the top of a luxury hotel and opened up fire At the end of a festival featuring Kendrick Lamar and Travis Scott and Jay-Z, think about how that coverage would sound, okay? So the race thing here is quite obvious. In this clip of Chris Hayes and Rachel Maddow, there's another angle to take with this, which I actually, in fact, have a real problem with. I totally understand the sentiment, but I have a problem. Let's take a look.
Conversation about that in any way that follows the rational rules of argument.
And there is also this sense, I mean, we're standing here, and I have to say, like, for people watching at home, like, the sheer magnitude of this and the horror of how far away he was from what he was shooting at,
yeah,
which doesn't strike you until you're up against the scale of it. You know, there's this question about whether it was terrorism, and it just almost feels like that word has just been exploded of meaning. Because this was... If this isn't terrorism, then what the hell is terrorism? If, right. I mean, the sheer fear, terror, and panic that was imposed on the 22,000 people that were there, if that doesn't meet the definition, then, like, what the hell do we mean by the definition?
Well, I mean, the point of terrorism is to achieve a political, ideological aim separate and apart from the carnage that you've caused.
Right.
Whether it's by so infuriating the people who see themselves as compatriots with your targets that they lash out in
a way
that creates a convenient battle, or whether it's, you know, some other thing that derives from the crime itself, right? There's some tertiary goal.
Okay, so I actually am more inclined to agree with Rachel Maddow on that, and I think it's very important. There's one line that says, look, there is no doubt in some media coverage that terrorism that has been perpetuated by white nationalists, as an example, does not get written up the same way and certainly is not greeted with the same breathless hysteria as terrorism that emanates from a group like ISIS or Al-Qaeda, right? So it is very important that if we're talking about specific, as Rachel is saying there, there's some type of ideological origin there, whether it be religious or political in a certain fashion, that terrorism of the Ku Klux Klan, of white nationalists, of the alt-right, whatever, that be categorized as such. That category be clear, and it does not just apply to people acting in the name of Islamic, a particular brand of Islamic ideology. That's crucial. But this broader statement that we want to just start throwing this word terrorism around to cover everything, or that the answer to policies that are racist, that are built on profiling communities of color, that are built on building categories of oppression, distinction, state monitoring and surveillance, death and abuse, that we want to somehow add to that versus subtract to that, I have a fundamental problem with. So if we start saying, like, well, you know, look, I understand the sentiment and the race politics of this is obvious in terms of how it's covered, but the answer is not, you know, this is terrorism, profile this white guy. The answer is profile no one, solve actual crimes, and deal with policy that could prevent it. In this case, obviously, having to do with what types of guns are available and how they're regulated. But I think that discourse to go to things are awful, let's focus on distributing the awfulness more fairly versus subtracting from it and moving away from it is just important rhetorically. And I want to keep terrorism in a very clearly defined package and have it be, of course, applied to all manners of terrorism. That's fundamental. This is an act of mass murder. It's an act of cruelty. It's an act of insanity. It's in some ways, in fact, from my understanding of when I've read, and I have a bit, not much, but some, whenever I've read or listened to people who are involved in forensic psychology or who comment on this, they do say, in fact, it is better to not obsess over the people who perpetuate these crimes. It's better to not make them household names. It has a discouraging effect to some extent on people that might actually do something like this. And obviously, I mean, this is just in a certain sense, I mean, even the, you know, most obscene, grotesque actions that are motivated by an ideology, we can say, well, it's, you know, reflects this disgusting ideology, whatever it is. This is, you know, who could possibly understand why somebody would do something this grotesque? And I have no real interest in, you know, there are people who do this professionally who need to figure out this personality profile, how to prevent this from happening. I don't have any interest in it. I don't think the guy's interesting.
Well, I mean, he's only interested in the fact that he's like a rich real estate guy.
Right.
Like, that's the interesting element of it. He, who has the luxury to buy, like, dozens of high-powered, very expensive rifles.
Right. No, he's right. He's rich. He's privileged. He is, you know, in contradiction to all of our sort of stereotypes of, you know, that's, this is a good person. This, and you know, the last note, I mean, look at how, when Trump talks about this, yes, it's a tragedy. Yes, it's horrific. It's also, again, I don't want to get into that act of terrorism verbiage, but, like, I mean, Donald Trump has expressed more anger at football players trying to participate in American civic life than this fucking grotesque mass murderer. So take that what you will. This is a, there's no way to make this transition good, so I'm just going to do it. Bombfell. Look, for most guys, shopping can be a pain. I certainly don't like to do it. And Bombfell is an easier way for men to get better clothes. Bombfell is an online personal styling service that helps men find the right clothes for them. It's simple and straightforward. All you have to do is complete a questionnaire. A dedicated personal stylist will handpick pieces specifically for you. Then once you've viewed your selection, you have 48 hours to make any changes or even cancel altogether. So you're just at potentially the only real fun part of shopping, which is when everything has already been curated and you can just sort of sit back like a boss and be like, I think yes, I think no. You're in total control and you only pay for the clothes you keep. Plus, you have the option of receiving clothes once every 1, 2, or 3 months. Because Bombfell is on your side, they don't make money if you don't find something you don't find something you want to keep. I haven't gotten my first shipment yet, but I completed the questionnaire and I'm very excited to see what they do for me. Best of all, we've negotiated with Bombfell to get our listeners a special offer of $25 off your first purchase when you go to bombfell.com/majority. That's Bombfell, spelled BOMBFELL.com/majority. Bombfell, open and clothes. Harry's. I'm clean shaven. Took it all off today. And of course, I did it with my Harry's razor. For decades, one big razor company has relentlessly increased prices and reaped immense profits at the expense of its customers. So Jeff and Andy, two ordinary guys, were fed up with getting ripped off. Every time I do the Sanders thing, it hurts my shoulders. Started Harry's to fix shaving. Harry's knew that there was only one way to ensure quality. So they bought their own blade factory. By making less profit and selling directly over the internet, Harry's offers their blades at half the price. Just $2 compared to the $4 or more you'll pay at the drugstore. What I love most about my Harry's is it's great for sensitive skin. It moves smoothly. I've never cut myself with it. It's easy to travel with. Looks good. I'm a complete Harry's convert.
I've started very carelessly shaving in the shower without even a mirror just because the blades are that good.
You can do it with Harry's. Yep. Exactly. I've done that too, actually. It's kind of crazy. Not that we're advocating that. We're just talking about our own sort of irresponsibility. But Harry's is so good.
We're professionals.
Yeah, I think we know what we're doing. Harry's is so confident you'll love the blades that they're giving their first trial set for free. Just cover shipping. Your free trial includes a weighted ergonomic razor blade, 5 precision engineered blades with lubricating strip and trimmer blade, rich lathering shave gel, and a travel a blade cover. That's a $13 value for you to try. Stop messing around. Get started shaving with Harry's today by claiming your free trial offer, a $13 value for free. Just cover shipping to get it. To get your free trial, including a razor handle, fly blade, cartridge, shave gel, go to harrys.com/majorityreport right now. That's harrys.com/majorityreport. Tonight at 7 p.m., Michael Brooks Show. I have on ContraPoints. We're talking about quote-unquote free speech fetishists, how to defeat the alt-right, what exactly are trigger warnings. We're getting into all of that. She's brilliant. Very excited to have that conversation. And then also Bree Greyjoy is going to be in studio. We're talking about capitalism and cultural appropriation. Ton of you have signed up. If you haven't, you know, if you just want to check out the show, watch it 7 p.m. on the Majority Report YouTube channel, Michael Brooks Show on iTunes. You could read, we've like, I think 120 something reviews on there now. And of course, if you're ready to take the plunge, our numbers keep climbing and the Patreon makes it all possible. I appreciate the 650 something people that have already done it. Go to patreon.com/TMBS. We'll be right back with Cole Stangler on the Majority Report. Michael Brooks on the Majority Report. Joining us now is Cole Stangler. He is a Paris-based journalist covering labor and politics. You can see his writing in many publications, including In These Times, The Nation, and Jacobin. Cole, how are you doing?
Pretty good. Pretty good. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Cole, we're going to be talking about Emmanuel Macron's war on labor. The resistance strategy inside the French labor movement, and also how this might in fact fit into kind of Macron's broader project to neoliberalize the European Union, push it even further in a direction of austerity and kind of market orientation, which is already significantly jeopardized and undermined the EU project. Before we get there, though, there was this sense, I think, in Macron generally that, I mean, if you were on the left, you certainly always eyed him with a great deal of skepticism and concern. Then it was clear that the choice was between him and Le Pen. So if you were in France, you needed to vote for him. Or if you were outside of France, you said, you know, insofar as our opinions were relevant to French voters, you know, vote for him to make sure that there isn't an actual neo-fascist elected president. But this guy had a neoliberal agenda. He seemed to me, you know, that he in some ways was just a continuation or an accentuation of the previous socialist government of Francois Hollande, which already had moved very significantly to the right on economic issues. And now, several months in power, I mean, his popularity has declined significantly as he kind of wheels out this agenda. I mean, what's your sort of read on the Macron moment and how it's gone so far?
Well, I think the first thing you need to take account of is just the circumstances of his election. I think some people in the U.S. looked at his election, looked at his supermajority in parliament that he won, and then assume that he must have this big base of popularity. He won the second round of the vote against Marine Le Pen with around 2/3 of the vote. He won a huge majority in parliament. You know, the parliamentary victory came among record level abstention, that is people not turning out to vote. And his margin of victory over Le Pen, which was pretty significant, is explained almost entirely by the fact that his opponent was Marine Le Pen, who is a, as you put it, neo-fascist party, has indisputably neo-fascist roots. It's a far-right party, and fortunately, most people in France today still loathe Le Pen and still loathe everything National Front stands for. But I think from the very beginning, it's important not to confuse opposition to Le Pen with support for Macron. So that's the first thing, is that it can be a little deceiving if you look at those election results, the presidential election, and then even the legislative elections that followed, where people were very burned out and not interested in voting in that election, especially among young people, especially among working class people. So that's the first thing, is that Macron's base, his actual base, is very, very small as a share of the population. It's you know, well-educated, urban, middle-class professionals and wealthier people who aren't the majority of the French population. So that's the first thing. And I think as his policies have been rolled out over the last few months and his vision of governance become more clear, you're seeing some of that reflected in the polls, where people who voted for Macron to basically deny the presidency to Le Pen and to the odious, you know, hate that the National Front represents, are seeing what Macron actually stands for and what his government's trying to do. And I think that's what's being reflected in the polls right now. And it can be a little surprising, but his popularity is not really far from Trump territory, right? Which just give you a sense of how popular he is right now.
Absolutely. And on the thread, and just for even more context, I had mentioned François Hollande before, the previous president, who was a socialist, who did not seek re-election, who left office with truly an astonishing lack of popularity.
Yeah.
Macron had served him briefly. Macron, before forming his own party, was nominally a socialist. I mean, socialists, you know, in France, essentially we'll get to them in a moment, but it certainly does not mean necessarily someone of the left in the current context. And Hollande, who had defeated Sarkozy in 2012 on an anti-austerity agenda, had ended up basically capitulating to Angela Merkel's austerity freeze on the Eurozone, and then also trying to do some hacking at the French system himself. So other than the fact that obviously Macron is much younger, he's more, you know, dynamic, he's a better performer, he has a different brand, he represents a new party and a new thing, he's, you know, obviously obsessively trying to copy Obama, what is the difference? I mean, isn't there a lot of continuity? I mean, probably more severity under Macron, but isn't there a lot of continuity with what France had already rejected under a kind of right-leaning socialist government?
Yeah, I think so. I think Macron combines the kind of social liberalism of Hollande. You know, under Hollande, France legalized same-sex marriage, you know, which was a big victory.
Right.
And had a progressive social agenda that's matched with, you know, a neoliberal economic platform. I would say that the big discrepancy between the two administration so far, and we're still very early in the Macron one, is that in the Hollande camp, you saw lots of tension and infighting and kind of scuffles over which, you know, which side would be able to win out in various ministries and in various policies that were then implemented and proposed. The previous minister, the economic minister that preceded Macron, had a very different view of the economy, with a strong state as a factor, a tool for intervening in the economy,
right.
And basically was pushed out and then replaced with Emmanuel Macron. So I think you had some tension in the Hollande term. Right now under Macron, it's basically everyone is on board with a what we'd say classic kind of neoliberal economic agenda, and that includes his economic minister Bruno Le Maire, who, it should be pointed out, he was on the extreme liberal side, liberal in an economic sense, the extreme neoliberal side of the right-wing party, Les Républicains, and was a candidate in that primary and ended up losing. But he was, had great plans for eliminating hundreds of thousands of state functionary jobs, and it became this kind of contest to see how many state functionary jobs can you promise to eliminate. Anyhow, Bruno Le Maire is the economic minister for Macron. The prime minister for Macron, Edouard Philippe, also comes from the right-wing party. So I would say that the Macron government is pretty universally supportive of this neoliberal economic model where there was more tension in the Alam camp.
Right. So what specifically is he doing? And maybe also I think for people here, there it might be somewhat useful if there is a distinction, because obviously the baseline in France is so much further in terms of kind of like a basic acceptance of things like, you know, like every other kind of advanced country. So, you know, something like Macron is obviously not proposing doing away with universal health care as an example. So, you know, there might be some social safety net questions that might be interesting to get into. But the main war, as far as I understand it, is on labor. And that's about eliminating state jobs. It's about eliminating protections. It's about lowering wages. What is the sort of, you know, and first of all, am I right? Is that the kind of main bulwark of his neoliberalism? And then specifically, how does it look for the French labor and public sectors?
So, yeah, I think right now the big battle right now is over labor reform. You're right. There are some other reforms that he's going to be unveiling over the next few months, if not next few years. One of the big ones maybe we could get to after the labor discussion is he wants to eliminate a wealth tax that's very controversial. Well, controversial among certain
people.
among wealthy people.
Right.
The idea of if you make above a certain amount, which in France right now starts about 800,000 euros, you have to pay a tax on that wealth. And this is something that the right in France has long tried to eliminate. Big business wants to get rid of it. Rich people want to get rid of it. And it's part of a big reform Macron's planning to unveil. So that's coming down the pipeline. And that's, I think, really indicative of kind of his vision. We can get to that. But you're right. Right now, the big issue is labor reform. And this, you know, ostensibly, if you listen to the government's discourse, what they're saying is that, and this has been a talking point for quite some time now, it's the idea that France has this high unemployment rate, which is true. It's around 10%, mm-hmm. which is, you know, higher than some of its neighbors. The idea is that France's unemployment rate basically is, you know, flows from the fact that there's too much labor regulation and unions have too much power. And that's the kind of equation here that they're making. And therefore, in order to really address this unemployment crisis, we need to basically eliminate regulations that give unions too much power, eliminate protections that ensure people can't get laid off without cause. And that's kind of the logic that's at play here. And there's, you know, needless to say, there's a whole bunch of debate over the tie between unemployment and labor regulation is really that significant in the first place. But basically, the reforms that are being unveiled right now, and they've already been approved, still need to be ratified by Parliament. But what they boil down to is basically eliminating, making it easier for companies to lay workers off, to lay people off, and basically removing the power of unions to collectively bargain in a number of circumstances. I mean, I don't know, we can get into specifics if you like. It can get kind of in the minutia pretty quickly. But, you know, suffice to say, for France, these are pretty radical measures. I'll give you just one example, which has a lot of people upset. You know, unlike the United States, France has, you know, what you might deem in American terms to be a kind of just cause, quote, just cause employment system, which is to say, you know, in the U.S. you can be laid off without cause at all, you know, by any employer, right, unless you have a union and that specifies in the contract that you can't. France, on the other hand, you don't need a union to have that protection. It basically applies across the board.
Right.
And if employers violate the law, if they lay you off without cause, if they can't provide a reason for why they're laying you off, you have the right to basically sue them in these special administrative labor courts that then give out penalties based on whether the layoffs were justified or not. So kind of that provides a bulwark against unfair layoffs. And companies complain about this because they don't like the fact that they're on the hook for laying people off.
Right, of course.
And so one of the big aspects of the reforms here that's pretty unpopular is that this would for the first time put a ceiling on the damages that can be awarded. And they set very specific limits for damages based on how much experience you have. For example, someone who has spent 2 years on the job at a specific employer, if they get laid off without cause, they then have a limit on the amount they could receive, which is no more than 3 months' pay. So that's for someone who's been on the been on the job for 2 years. The idea here is that this is kind of setting up a system where employers know you can, you know, basically cane people if you just are willing to pay this extra amount, you know, which has kind of trade unionists and labor law experts kind of questioning if this is really undermining the undermining a key plank of the employment protection system.
Yeah, no doubt.
So that, yeah.
No, just two questions, I mean, that I want to circle back on briefly. I think it's important to drill down on this. It's been a very generic talking point, certainly in the United States. Anytime somebody would kind of talk about, you know, the European social model, and, you know, which obviously is not a utopia by any stretch of the imagination, but at the same time has produced some, you know, very significant advantages and benefits that have to do with basic political trade-offs. The choice that things like balancing worker and business rights are, you know, important, that there's something, you know, it's beneficial to the economy to not just sort of endlessly give rich people money. And then that there's, you know, basic ethical and civic obligations with things like healthcare and so on. The response has always been, well, you know, you can do that, but your economy will be terrible, blah, blah, blah. I guess, why is, you know, what is the kind of, what would the French Keynesians or the French, you know, socialists or the French labor leaders say about why France is stuck at that 10% unemployment and why it isn't about, you know, the fact that they have a strong labor system?
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, France has been never really recovered from, if you want to go really back to you know, the 70s, after the post-war boom era, France has had high unemployment and pretty meager economic growth since then. And, you know, it can be hard to compete in a, you know, a global capitalist economy that's difficult, where you have costs that are being driven down across the world. And, you know, people are flocking to new sources of labor and investment. So I think that it's, you know, globalization is a big, plays a big factor here. But I think, you know, when people talk about, and I mean, it's, I think you're correct to bring up the question of trade-offs here, because, you know, I don't want to idolize the French system, certainly not, because there's poverty here. It's actually been rising a little bit increasingly. You know, there's inequality. But if you compare a country like France to a country like Germany, which is the supposed, you know, paradise for, you know, a country that supposedly swallowed the, you know, the tough labor reforms and now has lower unemployment, you know, Germany also has serious, serious problems with employment precarity. Right. A lot of those jobs that have been created, you know, they don't pay very well. They pay below minimum wage because the law allows for that. They're very short-term jobs, and there's a very intense patronizing unemployment system where people are forced to, you know, you have retirees, people that are about to retire, they're forced to take these low-paying jobs because they can't find work and the government forces them to. So there's all kinds of problems with the German model, which France is often, you know, counterposed with. So again, I don't want to idealize, you know, France too much, or, but it's worth pointing out here that these are certain trade-offs. And the fact of the matter is, you know, if you're a average, you know, working class person, you know, odds are the standard of living in France is it's probably better to be in France than it is to be in Germany and certainly in the United Kingdom.
Right.
You know, where protections are few and far between, and even have, you know, even more dangerous employment precarity questions. So, you know, this is, you know, French labor leaders and Keynesians, as you put it, have been, you know, have solutions of their own to address the unemployment crisis. They've been putting these out for, you know, for quite some time. They don't get a lot of attention in, I don't know, The Economist or, you know, whatever, you know, New York Times op-ed people are weighing into France's supposed ills. But people have been talking about lowering the working week as a way of basically sharing the labor to help address the crisis. You know, making it a 32-hour work week is one proposal that's on the table, which I know can sound a little radical maybe to some American ears, but it's something that, you know, is a common sense solution. You know, people have been floating the idea of a universal basic income, got a lot of attention in the presidential election. earlier this year. People are also lowering the minimum wage, or excuse me, increasing the minimum wage. People have proposals on the table here. It's a question of where the political balance of forces is, and right now, it's pretty clear that they're in Macron's camp. Although that could change very quickly, and we're seeing, in the polls that there is a lot of opposition as well.
We'll get back to Macron in a minute before we wrap up. But I mean, just what is the state of opposition? Is there what is the current power of labor and left opposition? What's happening? And give us a small kind of tour, I guess. And I mean, it is brief, but just touch if you can on the labor. But also, I mean, is now that Macron is owning the center right ground, I mean, does that mean that the Socialist Party needs to kind of rediscover its actual social democratic roots? Then, of course, you have Mélenchon, who very good in my view on economics and inequality in a lot of ways, but also said some truly repulsive things about the Vichy era. So there's complexity there, but. What is this sort of state of kind of general from labor to center left to left opposition to what Macron is doing?
Yeah, so I'll get to the unions in a sec, but just politically, as you put it, Macron's governing from a center right, and very, very smartly, very astutely, he knows what he's doing, and by bringing on these right-wing ministers, he's basically, and implementing a program of the right, he's basically neutralized the Republicans, as the party is called, as basically a force. So
right.
The Republicans have been kind of muzzled in Parliament, because they support what he's doing, and they like what he's doing, while nominally remaining a force of opposition. And they're the largest opposition force, quote-unquote opposition force in Parliament. And then you have the Socialist Party, which has basically just disappeared from I think is the right way to put it. They've said they've been nominally critical of these labor reforms, but they haven't endorsed any of the protests. The elected parliamentarians of the Socialist Party, many of them were favorable towards Hollande's turn to the right. So it's a very kind of centrist, center, liberal-leaning, liberal in the European sense, Socialist Party that's very small. The National Front, despite having a record number in the presidential election, has also been effectively, silenced here because they have been dealing with inner turmoil. And all of this has meant, when you take all those factors into consideration, all of this has meant that the opposition to Macron, from at least a political sense, has basically been in the camp of Jean-Luc Mélenchon and France Insoumise.
Mm-hmm.
And polls reflect that very clearly right now, that his party is seen as basically the leading force of opposition to Macron, because he's continually criticizing the economic program here. He's criticizing the means in which they're implementing it. So this labor reform is being implemented through executive order, basically a fast-track process to bypass regular parliamentary debate. Mélenchon's been hitting him hard on that. So much to the point where France Insoumise, Mélenchon's party, actually called for their own day of protest against these reforms and against what they call the social coup d'etat on September 23rd. This was a France Insoumise protest, and they brought out, they say, 150,000 people to the streets. The police said 30,000, pick somewhere in the middle.
Right.
That Mélenchon's call for protest was not without some controversy, because it upset a lot of the trade unionists, who also had called for their own days of protest. So first on September 12th, calling for a day of action and protests and strikes, which drew hundreds of thousands out across the country. And then the following week on the 21st, 2 days before Mélenchon's protest, trade unions held another day of rally and protests and strikes that was a little bit smaller than the one of the previous week, but still mobilized hundreds of thousands of people. So you had those three big days of protests, and the movement has kind of been figuring out what are the next steps here. Because if these labor reforms are going to be blocked, I think it's pretty clear the only way they're going to be blocked is if there's a massive, massive movement, which is not unprecedented in France. But if you have a massive movement that puts enough pressure on Parliament to the point where Parliament basically decides it's not worth implementing these reforms because the country is being paralyzed and it's time to give in. So that's basically the only way this is going to happen, is if the political side, if Mélenchon's camp and Labour can get together and get more of Labour together and more Labour on board with the idea of protest and blocking this law. If that happens in the next few weeks, there's a chance, you know, that Parliament could budge. But you know, we haven't seen that yet. The next day to look out for is October 10th. There is a day of protest that's called by the actually public sector unions, which are not directly impacted by these labor reforms, but they're actually protesting other parts of Macron's agenda that affect public sector workers, notably calls to eliminate 120,000 functionary jobs. And some of the unions, the private sector unions, so all the public sector unions will be there October 10th. Some of the private sector unions, because they see this as an opportunity, have also been calling to come out and protest and go on strike that day, October 10th. And hopefully, you know, we'll see if Mélenchon's camp does the same. But that could be a big day to look out for. And then again, to see if, you know, if these actions can actually extend beyond just these one day, you know, symbolic days of protest and actually see real strikes in workplaces. Because if history is any lesson, that's what actually gets the results. And just to bring up a couple examples, this actually has worked in the past. In 1995, there was a very famous law that was basically the government withdrew it because there was so much protest and so much strike action. The Juppé plan to reform Social Security, cut Social Security. That was in 1995. Then in 2006, you had another law that was actually the government withdrew it in the face of popular protest. This one was over a youth employment contract. There was so much student protest, so much strike action that the government decided it wasn't worth it.
So there's a lot to learn from France for everybody with regards to those sort of things. Quick question. You know, when you look at Macron, this guy seems like it's so bizarre because on one hand, there's this kind of brand, you know, and on a certain level, relative to French politics, he's young. He's doing a lot of things with his presidency that I think like, most men in their 30s would do if they became president, like, you know, jumping, like, you know, like going on submarine rides and skydiving and, yeah, you know, and all this sort of stuff. But his political profile, his rhetoric, his kind of like, you know, fetishization of apps, Silicon Valley, and all this kind of like weird sort of technocrat utopia kind of soft-headed Thomas Friedman thinking, you know, he would be better. Like, he seemed like he should be at some third way summit in 1999 or
potentially.
I guess maybe, you know, in some ways in with Obama, who he obviously idolizes in 08 or 09. I mean, you kind of have, you know, Justin Trudeau is a slightly similar profile, but Justin Trudeau doesn't even seem to kind of have the same, you know, Justin Trudeau just has a more simple media strategy, which is like, you know, be the woke nice guy and then push through the Canadian. Stop. Yeah. Do, you know, help make Canada sell oil and arms and then, you know, whatever. But Macron has a, you know, a much kind of more pretentious self-concept, it seems like. So, you know, my read has always been that this isn't going to end well. Maybe now, I mean, best case, there's a resurgence of the far left and real leftism in France. But also the other scenario is, you know, I mean, he pushes off the National Front for now, but then, you know, lays the groundwork for them to succeed in the future by continuing this neoliberal assault on people, which has helped, you know, give rise to this rebirth of neo-fascism globally anyway. So, I mean, what's the kind of end game here? I mean, even as he's kind of hitting his stride, to me, it's like, it does not seem like a long-term project. And why do they keep electing these people that they hate?
The last question you just asked would take a lot of time.
Yeah, that's fine. Table that one. That's fine.
But what you were saying, I think, is you're like spot on. Yeah. I mean, other people have brought this up, but there's something that's really ironic and hopefully not tragic about the fact that, I mean, you know, Macron has this super ambitious discourse that's delivered in these you know, extremely technocratic terms. Again, like the as you put it, you know, the fetishization of Silicon Valley and apps and you know, blending the right and the left as if this is this new unprecedented you know, way of doing politics, like, which basically boils down to old fashioned, you know, third way. That, you know, these are the politics that Macron's framing them in this really new flashy way as if they'd never been implemented before. But these are the same politics that we've actually seen, you know, that the UK, you know, implemented in, you know, in the 80s and 90s, you know, with New Labour and Thatcher.
He's talking about politics. iPhone politics. What he's doing is it's CD-ROM politics. The stuff is older. I mean, that's the irony, right? Yeah.
And you know, in the U.S., and it's like what is the result? What are the results of those kind of politics? We know what they are in the U.K. and the U.S. In the U.K., what happened in the last few years? We had, you know, mounting inequality and just disconnection of Westminster from the country, resulting in Brexit. But what you've seen in the U.S. happen is an absolute, you know, it's tragic with Donald Trump. Like, we know these politics have been tried. We know what happens with them. So to see Macron doing this whole, you know, play over again is it's you know, it's upsetting, it's ironic and hopefully not tragic. You know, we'll see what happens, but it's a really dangerous you know, ground that we're going on right now. So you know, fortunately right now we're seeing most of the opposition is being captured by the left. You know, the National Front's going through some turmoil right now, but you know, we're still very, very early here in this term. So it's not looking good, and you know, I think if people want something to look forward to, I think the best hope right now is to, you know, is to look at what the French labor movement is doing, and hoping, you know, students can join this movement here, because if there's any way out of this, you know, it's going to be through the left, it's going to be through struggle, and you know, we'll see what happens over the coming weeks and coming years.
And a $30,000 makeup budget cannot protect you from that. All right, nope. Cole Stengler, he is a journalist based in Paris. He covers labor politics. He writes for The Nation, In These Times, Jacobin, many, many other fine, reputable places. Cole, thanks so much for taking the time.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Thanks, Cole. Welcome back. That was Cole Stengler. Okay, we are going to go to the fun half where we have a lot of sound to get to. We will... I don't even think too soon is a question anymore. It's like, yep, we're going to play this Alex Jones sound. It's funny. It's disgusting. I'm going to turn the IMs on. The phone number is, of course, 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. Become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. Subscribe to the show on YouTube and iTunes and all the other ways. Join me tonight, 7 p.m., The Michael Brooks Show. See you in the fun half. Think of all the times she said no, 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 no. Like to speak my mind. She said no, 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 no. And I know her time's not here. She didn't waste none on me. Situation sad. No, 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 no. Things are looking bad. She said no, 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 no. And if it was up to me, I'd tell her a thing or three. Every time I we